Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Professor Alexander Nemirov for Outlandish Life, Peter Paul Rubens and the Baroque, exploring the dramatic art of the 17th century. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California radio show. It's America's longest-running radio program. I'm Gloria Duffy, co-president and co-CEO of the club, a nonprofit, nonpartisan public forum that presents a wide range of thought leaders on important issues of the day. When President Reagan nominated Anthony Kennedy to the U.S. Supreme Court in 1988, few people expected that he'd not only serve for 30 years, but would also author landmark opinions on such contested issues in American society as abortion, gay rights, and free speech. At the ideological center of an increasingly divided court, Kennedy became the swing vote on many of the Roberts Court's 5-4 decisions following the retirement of Sandra Day O'Connor. He said he never wavered. As he put it, "The cases swing, I don't." That role earned him the moniker The Decider by Time magazine. But what judicial philosophy guided his time on the bench? How did he keep his judgment separate from his political and religious beliefs? These are all issues he explores in his new book, Life, Law, and Liberty, a memoir. To learn more about his approach to the law, we invited him to our headquarters in downtown San Francisco. This program is part of the Commonwealth Club series on ethics and accountability, generously underwritten by the Travers Family Foundation. Justice Kennedy was in conversation with ABC7 Bay Area news anchor and Commonwealth Club World Affairs Board member Dan Ashley. Before we get to their conversation, we wanted to play an excerpt from Justice Kennedy's book, Life, Law, and Liberty, a Memoir, narrated by himself.
Prologue. To understand ourselves, we should understand the time and place of our birth and origins. When we are rooted in a particular place, it defines our view of the world. It is interesting to note that 48 of the 56 signers of the Declaration of Independence were born in the colonies, born in what would become our America. Perhaps this explains their passion for freedom. My own view of the world was defined by the West. My father's parents had come to the American West from Ireland, seeking adventure, seeking opportunity, seeking freedom. They were by no means alone. Decade after decade, for well over a century, so many came to the West, the frontier, to find, to build. At first, in a vast land beyond the reach of the law, with no familiar social structures, those who came confronted the meaning of freedom in a new, bold way, much as colonial leaders had done many generations earlier. Acquaintances, co-venturers, neighbors, and adversaries had to take the measure of one another and establish their respective rights. The common premise was simple, equality. The Western experience taught that each person is entitled to be treated no differently from the next, and should have the opportunity to prove his merit, her character, his resourcefulness, her strength. The West contained within it a belief in what was possible. Growing up in the West taught me, for example, that the creative energies of a great people cannot be realized unless the realms of economic freedom and personal liberty are respected. It reminded me that central to an individual's claim to personal liberty is the right to fair treatment and to be protected from arbitrary government action. The West reminded me that the most successful business person and the lowest paid worker are each entitled to this basic dignity, a dignity that helped Americans build the frontier and continues to help us today. The West is so central to my self-understanding that it seems an appropriate place to begin. this Western boy did later go east. But my hope was to stay always close to those Western ideas of liberty and justice. This memoir is my way of putting those ideas on paper, of explaining how a Western boy became a lawyer, a judge, and a justice, seeking always to honor our country's founding principles, and to do so with civility, hard work, tolerance, and the ethical foundation our nation must preserve.
That was Justice Anthony M. Kennedy reading from his book, Life, Law, and Liberty, a Memoir. Now let's hear what Anthony Kennedy had to share with Dan Ashley.
Hello and welcome to today's Commonwealth Club World Affairs program. My name is Dan Ashley, anchor for ABC 7 News and a proud member of the Commonwealth Club World Affairs Board of Governors. Now it is my great pleasure to introduce Justice Anthony Kennedy, author of Life, Law, and Liberty, a Memoir. Throughout his 30-year tenure on the U.S. Supreme Court, Justice Anthony Kennedy authored landmark opinions on some of the most contested issues in history, including free speech, abortion, and gay rights. Born in Sacramento, California, he received his BA from Stanford University and the London School of Economics, and his LLB from Harvard Law School. He was in private practice and taught constitutional law before joining the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit here in this area. Between his service on the U.S. Court of Appeals and the U.S. Supreme Court, Justice Kennedy has written nearly 1,000 opinions. Justice Kennedy retired from the Supreme Court in 2018. Justice Kennedy, welcome and congratulations on your new book. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here in San Francisco. My grandparents on my mother's side lived in San Francisco, and it was very special for us. My grandfather owned the biggest trucking company in San Francisco.
Is that right?
And knew everybody on the wharf. He would go down the wharfs, and everybody knew Mac, and I would sometimes, you know, 7 or 8 year olds ride with him in one of his big yellow trucks. And one time he went in to a bar in San Francisco. And in those days, I don't know if it's still true, but there was a bar for Republicans and for Democrats. and he was a Democrat, but he went in the Republican bar. The bartender said, "Well, Frank," he said, "it's wonderful to see you. Thank you so much for coming in." He said, "And why are you a Democrat?" He said, "Oh," he said, "my grandfather was a Democrat. My father was a Democrat, so I'm a Democrat." And he said, "Well, suppose your grandfather was a horse's ass and you were a horse. And your father was a horse's ass. What would that make you?" He said, "Oh, a Republican." No, they had a good sense of humor in San Francisco those days.
Outstanding. What a great way to start us off. Yeah, that's fantastic. I may have to steal that one. That's a good one. We have a lot to delve into, of course, in terms of decisions and political climate and the role of the Supreme Court. All of that we'll get to. And, of course, this great book you've written, which is, by the way, a terrific read. Very interesting. But I want to start with this, if I can, Your Honor. When you were sworn in after being unanimously approved for the Supreme Court, confirmed, in that moment that you were sworn in as a Supreme Court Justice of the United States, one of only 110 or 15 people to ever hold that position. It's the pinnacle of the legal world. How did that land on you? What did that mean? What were you thinking about in that really profound moment in just a person's life?
It's interesting. It was beyond my full understanding at the time. I didn't realize the historic consequences and the social consequences and the legal consequences of the job. There are just 9 of us, and almost any social problem can find its way into a case.
Sure.
So the Supreme Court has countless numbers of issues on which our nation is vitally interested in, and the burdens and the importance of it and the historic significance only became more clear to me over time.
It was a proud moment, no doubt, for you as an accomplishment as an attorney. And
oh, well, of course, we didn't want to leave California. But I told President Reagan, Mary and I were both born in Sacramento. Our kids all went to Stanford, and we thought we'd be Californians. I said, we don't want to come back. We don't know anybody back here. He said, oh, you know me. I said,
it's a good person to know.
I said, what am I supposed to do? Come for lunch every day? but he and Nancy always liked Mary. He said, oh, Washington's Mary's kind of town. And he said, and the rule is if I ask you, you have to come. And when he was governor, my private practice, what I did, I would see him sometimes on legal matters. He would say, now the rule is, I say, Governor, I tell you the rule. Do what you want, but I tell you the rule. And so when he asked me to come back, I said, we're not sure. Mary agrees with me. We're not sure we want to leave California. So, the rule is, if I asked you, you have to come back. And I said, are you going to tell me the rule again? But it's true. If he asked you, you have to come back.
You have to do it. Well, you know, your grandfather was in the trucking business.
Yes.
Your father was an attorney. I'm curious, what, obviously you had that connection with your father, but what compelled you to pursue a career in the law? What was it about it that attracted you?
Well, initially, I thought it would be good to be a medical doctor. One of my best friends lived just 6 houses away, and his father was a doctor. And my friend would drive. In those days, the general practitioner would go to the patient's home.
Right.
And often the doctor would phone me at 5 and say, we're leaving at 5 to go on the house calls. And, not, is it okay with me? But, I had to go. So I was in the homes of ill people, dying people, and I saw this wonderful doctor. And when he came to the house that night, it was so special. And he had this marvelous bedside manner. And so my initial thought was I wanted to be a doctor, but I just didn't have the technical talents, either from the skill with my hands or ability. At Stanford, I took biology, and I just couldn't work the microscope like James Thurber. I finally drew something. It was my own eye.
So Eureka.
So I said I better become a lawyer.
We have that in common. My father was a doctor, and I didn't have the skill set to pursue that either. You talked a lot about Sacramento and your time here, and it's certainly reflected in the book. Being a Western person with Western sensibilities and Western values has been pivotal in your life. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, the West, for generations, drew people from the East, first, to go to what is now called the Midwest and further and further. And that's because this magnificent country of ours welcomed people to come and settle where you could define your own self, define your own destiny. There was open space, literally and figuratively. And so people were drawn to the West because we could see new opportunities, new capacities. You could shape your own destiny. In California, Steinbeck wrote East of Eden.
Right.
You always want to reaching. Is there still an Eden to go to once you're in California? Well, you can go to Honolulu, but that doesn't quite work. But the answer is yes. California, with its richness, its beauty, its resources, its dynamic people, still opens up great opportunities.
And in so many ways, it's always struck me that California, especially in the early days, but even to this day, is very much about the future.
Yes.
And sometimes in the back east, history in the past is also very pivotal. California is always moving forward in such dramatic ways. But it also shaped your sensibility around dignity, personal dignity, and liberty, did it not? And which informed some of your legal.
Well, that's a really interesting point. Just because the West has all these magnificent opportunities and opens up so many new ideas and possibilities for you, doesn't mean that the East doesn't either. The East just starts in a different way. The East looks at what it accomplished in the past, in colonial times, the time of the founding. And sure, the East looks at its past and says, this is what we can do. And then it looks to the future that way. So the East looks to the future just as well. One of the reasons seemed to me valuable to go to the Harvard Law School was I thought, sure, I would be practicing in California for my whole life, and I wanted to see what the East Coast was like. But it turned out you can't make those judgments very early.
But, you know, that idea of dignity really kind of was a foundational value for your ideas around constitutional liberty in some respects. Is that right? Is that fair to say that the individual dignity was pivotal in your outlook?
The Constitution uses the word life, liberty, and property. The Declaration of Independence uses the word life, liberty, and happiness, and sometimes you get them mixed up.
Right.
But we couldn't put life, liberty, and happiness in the Constitution, because how can you enforce happiness? Well, some judges would be very glad to try. but that's why we say life, liberty, and property. But liberty was an expansive term. If the framers had known all of the specifics of what makes for a just society, they would have written down. They knew that the idea of justice, the dimensions of freedom, are disclosed over time. So they use spacious words like liberty.
And you write about this. Liberty, is, in your view, is sort of a dynamic concept that changes over time in some respects. Can you describe what you mean by that?
Well, once again, going back to the framers, they were modest enough to know that they did not know all of the aspects, all of the dimensions of a just society. They knew that the idea of liberty must be disclosed over time. And we're just 1 year away from the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, 2026. And one of the things we're doing is we've been asked to have a time capsule, to make a time capsule to open 250 years from now. I'm not even sure, especially with AI, what the United States is going to look like 10 years from now.
Let alone 250.
If you look backwards, suppose the framers made a time capsule. What would they put in it? The Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and when we pull it out 250 years later, it still has meaning, it still has force, it still has promise, it still has reverence, it still defines the American people. We're defined by the Constitution. Constitution, if you read a political theory, especially written in Europe, it's usually spelled with a small c. It means the sum total of customs, mores, traditions in a society. That's their constitution. And we sometimes talk about a person with a strong constitution. That's a small c. And we, too, have a small c constitution in our customs and tradition. But when we talk about constitution, we usually think of a capital C.
Right.
The document that was written shortly after the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration of Independence was the promise. The Constitution was the fulfillment.
Hmm. That's a great way to phrase it. Continuing on what you said, if we pulled out that time capsule today that founding fathers had prepared for us, what would they think about where we are today? Did we honor the Constitution in the way that they would have intended?
Yes, because it continued to define the American people. Jefferson thought the Constitution would last about 20 years.
Is that right?
And he thought it would be amended all the time. When he signed the Louisiana Purchase, he wasn't sure that it was lawful. But he said, if it isn't, they can amend the Constitution. But our Constitution has been amended in major respects only about three times. So you have to count the Bill of Rights as one.
Right.
That's one time. Then the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment, those are the Civil War amendments. That's the second time. That's the same dynamism. And then I think women's rights came a little, you know, Abigail Adams complained to John Adams in the 1770s that women's rights were not in the Constitution.
Hmm.
And it took until 1919 for that to happen.
But in the end, it was probably a wise decision to make it difficult to amend the Constitution so that it doesn't happen all the time or not.
I think that's correct.
That it's not an easy process.
It is.
Yeah. We've also talked a lot about the role of the judge is not to impose personal or moral beliefs, but sort of have neutral views. How difficult is that? How difficult was it when you were an attorney? You know, you're Catholic with deep Catholic religious beliefs, and you are Republican with certainly conservative beliefs in that respect, but you've made so many interesting rulings that maybe belie some of those aspects of your background. How difficult was that for you to keep sort of personal judgments about things out of the equation? And is it more difficult today than it was?
Every judge in every case, every day, has to ask himself or herself, why am I doing this? Is there some hidden bias, some motive that I don't see, that I don't understand? And suppose a judge 3 months ago decided a case between A and B. Then 3 months later, the same issue comes back between X and Y, unrelated to the first. The judge has a duty to ask himself or to ask herself, was I right? Who am I? One of the first words in Shakespeare's Hamlet is, who goes there? And Hamlet, throughout the play, has to ask, who am I? And judges must do this every time. Now, frankly, people in all professions have to do this. Sure. Why am I saying this? Why am I doing this? And so it's not unique to the law, but the judge has a sworn duty to ask that question in every case to find out who he or she is.
Is that a personal challenge to separate that aspect of yourself from the legal decision?
Well, of course it always is. You can't get through the day without making an immediate judgment, without sitting down and saying, well, why am I doing this? And so, of course, you have an initial reaction. Oh, this is right or this is wrong. But the fascinating part about judging the NUS is if it's difficult, it's fascinating. It's interesting. That's what keeps us thrilled to be doing what we're doing, is that we always ask the question, what does the law require? What lies ahead?
You talk in the book about the judge's mindset. Is that what this really is, the judge's mindset?
Yes, it seemed to me that that's what we've just been talking about.
Yeah. You spoke about the court's duty to preserve public confidence as well. And given that aspect, given today's polarized climate and some of the ethics controversies, do you believe the Supreme Court has lost public trust?
It's interesting. If you have a graph and the political approval of the executive branch, the lunch goes down, the court goes down with it. You would think it might be the other way around. Oh, at least we have one branch that knows what it's doing. But we have to be very careful in this day and age to recognize that we are in a crisis of incivility. Democracy presumes ongoing discussion, which is reasoned, thoughtful, decent and respectful of the person with whom you disagree. And what do they call it? A political identity?
Yeah.
The internet's interesting. When the internet seemed to me, and perhaps many others, that, oh, we'll now be able to talk to more people. But the internet, apparently people talk only to those who have their same political beliefs.
Right.
It's become more polarizing, not less. There have been some books written about this. It was quite surprising to me. But we have to understand that democracy presumes a thoughtful, rational, decent, respectful discourse in which two people disagree and then they go out to dinner together. This isn't happening. And Aristotle pointed out that democracies can die, and he'd seen it. And he said democracy presumes the existence of a thoughtful, ongoing, rational, friendly discussion. This is thousands of years ago. He taught this, and we're not listening to that lesson. I'm very concerned with the incivility, the hostile, fractious discourse in our country, and we must try to change it.
Do you consider that a major threat to democracy or a significant threat to democracy?
Yes.
Yeah.
Although, ultimately, I'm optimistic because this is such a great nation.
Right, it is. What will it take to restore civility in this country and in the halls of Congress and in Washington?
Recognition of its importance and a commitment to restore it.
Hmm. Easier said than done, obviously, given this climate.
You're so correct.
Let's talk about some of the issues that you debated in the Supreme Court and ruled on. I'd like to start maybe with the death penalty and the case involving the juvenile death penalty decision. Very emotional, and you wrote the majority opinion on that. Describe the case for people and what the issues were in your mind.
Well, this was one of those issues on which I changed my mind. In first coming on the court, I joined an opinion in which the majority, I think it was 6-3, could have been a 5-4, 6-3, held that it was lawful to execute a person who, although 18 at the time or 18 or more, had committed the crime as a juvenile. And we held that it was lawful to execute that person. Over time, my mind changed.
In fact, you say here's still the facts of the case and the arguments for and against executing a minor were so similar in this second case that at the end of the day, my first vote was simply wrong. And you literally changed your mind.
Yes. And what we're talking about is the cruel and unusual punishments clause. And the court has said that for that, we refer to the understanding that society as a whole has as to what is cruel and unusual. That doesn't mean we take a public opinion poll, mm-hmm. but that's just a factor we look to. And it seemed to me that society, social science, the courts, and the general public were beginning to take a harder look at juveniles. There's some juveniles at age 15 who know exactly what they're doing. They have an adult mindset, and there are people at 21 that don't. But as a general rule, the adolescent is still finding out who he is, who she is, learning over time, and they're impulsive. We all know this about young people. So it seemed to me that as a general rule, minors should be treated differently. And we held that this young man who had committed, it was a serious crime. In this case, he and some others had gone to a woman's house when her husband was away. They molested her, they tied her up with tape, and they threw her off a bridge and killed her. Mm-hmm. And it was a terrible, terrible crime. And to say that we can use these facts to say that, oh, we can't get the death penalty is a difficult case. But that was our conclusion. And at my suggestion, one of my clerks did question some young people who'd been sentenced to death, and then the decision came out that they couldn't be executed, to see what their reaction was. And they had life sentences. And over time, many of them had contributed to prison life. Some of them were, California has a program where prisoners can paint, they can write. And prisons, the whole subject of prisons is a difficult one.
Indeed. Let's talk about another very difficult subject, which you wrote a majority opinion on, which is abortion, specifically yeah. partial birth abortions. And this is a passage from the book. This is a very difficult subject, and each person must explore it for themselves. It is not for judges to rule on the personal morality of a choice, but rather on the permissibility of it under the Constitution. And our Constitution underscores the importance of thoughtful, rational, decent decisions made by individuals and families without interference from the government. This was a topic that was challenging for you personally as a Catholic, and one that you wrote had you considering maybe stepping away because it was so challenging.
It was. This was pre-viability abortions. After the infant was viable, well, the court said that, of course, abortions could be prohibited. But in the pre-viability state, it seemed to me that the woman did have the right to choose, but that our duty, for those of us who believe that life begins at the moment of conception, was our duty to try to convince them not to get the abortion, to use form. To point out, there's the voice of the law, the voice of the woman. There's also the voice of the unborn saying, let me live, let me live.
And you write here at the concluding this chapter, this power to persuade but not to coerce is what free speech and an open and decent society should be about. Persuade, not coerce. Talk about that.
Well, freedom means you should have choice. And our theory of government is that, of course, we need law and order. Of course, we need laws. Of course, we need order. But in our theory, the law makes a fence and gives you a wide area of freedom where you can make your own choices, where you can exercise free will and freedom in discovering your own identity and pursuing it.
This is the Commonwealth Club of California radio program featuring former Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy in conversation with Dan Ashley. Thank you for joining us for this program, the latest episode of the longest-running radio show in the United States. Please stay in touch with Commonwealth Club World Affairs, our events, the travel program, and more by subscribing to our email newsletter at commonwealthclub.org/email and following us on social media. Now, back to our program.
Let's talk about gay rights, something that you were very involved in on the court. You write, based on my position in cases unrelated to gay rights, the other justices knew that, in my view, substantive rights can be found in the liberty provisions of the Fifth and the 14th Amendments. My colleagues knew, too, that religious and traditional family values had led me to feel some personal conflict over these matters. Tension between one's own beliefs and the demands of the law is common. You've talked about that here. Because my colleagues knew of these tensions and the cases looked as if they would be closely divided, the opinions were assigned to me. Was that did that add a great deal of stress to your life?
Yes. Well, one of the things we use our law clerks for is before we meet with our colleagues, we sit down with our law clerks, wonderful young people who come to us for 1 year at a time. And we have a debate in chambers just to get ready so that when you read through these briefs, stacks and stacks of them, you're prepared for what the arguments might be. And in this case, my law clerks at my request reached back thousands of years to see if there was any such thing as a marriage between two people of the same sex. And the answer was no. The island of Lesbos, that's a maybe, but that's, it was a small matter. But it is true that, and the meaning of womanhood changed. It was not long ago, from a historic standard, maybe 200 years, that the woman in the marriage, that the wife was owned by the man. If there were a divorce, the man got the child. The man got the property. Of course, the woman, of course, didn't have the right to vote. Or in the family context, the right to keep the children or to have any rights against the husband. This changed, as we now know. And it seemed to me that this change indicated that the idea of marriage can change. Now you say, same sex, that we could not find. But it was very important to me to find something that we had not known, or at least had not come to my knowledge, that there were hundreds of thousands of children adopted by gay parents. And the prohibition against allowing the two women or the two men to marry was very hard on these children. It meant often in some states, depending on the state, that only one parent, the leading parent, because the state allowed only one person to adopt, could come into the hospital or sign a report card, and this was very hard on the children who had to tell their friends they had only one parent. And this was quite significant for me, the burden that this placed on the children of gay marriage, hundreds of thousands of them. These are the kind of things that are important in judicial decisions to see what is the meaning, what is the effect of this law that you're looking at.
The opinion that was Obergefell versus Hodges, wasn't it?
Yes.
Describe that opinion, please.
It was an opinion in which three or four different cases were consolidated under one case. Mm. And the Obergefell was the name of the case. And in some of the cases, one of the couple had died. And the question was whether the surviving person had the same rights as any other spouse in a conventional marriage. And it seemed to me important to say that it was only just the gay couple would have the right to the dignity and the significance and the respect that marriage meant. It didn't mean they disrespected marriage. It means they respected it so much they wanted it for themselves. And part of the opinion that it was my honor to write passed this refrigerator test. You know what the refrigerator test is?
I was going to ask you about this. You talk about the refrigerator test.
The refrigerator test is if there's something well written, and sometimes it happens at the Supreme Court, the mother or the father puts it on the refrigerator so the family can read it.
And isn't that great?
Part of this was past the refrigerator test, apparently. People, I didn't know. I'd never heard about the refrigerator test.
Well, it's a great, and I actually wanted to read this quick passage because it was actually made me, my wife and I last night, a little teary reading this when I read it to her. Just very profound, and this is regarding this case. The key passage is taped to the refrigerator door for family members to see. Here's one passage. I think you'll enjoy this. No union is more profound than marriage, for it embodies the highest ideals of love, fidelity, devotion, sacrifice, and family. In forming a marital union, two people became someone greater than they once were. As some of the petitioners in these cases demonstrate, marriage embodies a love that may endure even past death. It would misunderstand these men and women to say they disrespect the idea of marriage. Their plea is that they do respect it so deeply that they seek to find its fulfillment for themselves. Their hope is not to be condemned to live in loneliness, excluded from one of civilization's oldest institutions. They ask for equal dignity in the eye of the law. The Constitution grants them that right. Now, that's a very big post-it note to put that, but it's quite profound and powerful. I'd love for you to comment on that.
The whole purpose of our writing judicial opinions is to try to create allegiance to the result. Even if you disagree with the result, if you know that the court was thoughtful and careful and neutral in reaching its decision and gave reasons that were plausible, that may give you allegiance to the opinions, allegiance to the rule of law, even if you disagree with the result. One of the cases that I wrote an opinion in was the flag burning case. Mm. Texas had a rule, a law, that you could not burn an American flag. And some young man was mad at something and he burned an American flag. And he was convicted and actually sentenced to some term in prison. And the case came to us and the question was whether or not it's free speech. People said, you burn something and that's speech. Well, there, we have many ways of expressing ourselves. And it was clear to all of us that this was speech. The question was whether or not the state could prohibit it. And with an interesting division on the court included three justices who had fought in World War II, Rehnquist, White, Stevens, and they had fought for the flag. And there was a group of four thought that this was unconstitutional, that Texas could protect the American flag. And in my view, and a view of four of my other colleagues, because we became five of us, this was protected speech. And my opinion indicated that the Constitution protects speech that we desire. It's poignant but fundamental, that the Constitution protects the speech that is shocking to us all. After the flag burning case came out, we had issued the opinion just in the last week in June when the court was finishing its work, and we left just a few days later. But 80 senators about got to the floor of the Senate and denounced the court. And the editorial commentary was also very strongly against it because we love this flag and it's a beautiful flag. But it was very interesting, Dan, to note, and this is again the reason we write opinions, that over time, the next, I'll make it up, 3-4 months, public opinion began to change. People said, you know, that's my first free speech right. The government can't take away my right to speech. And one of our concerns, one of our points we made was, can Texas protect the flag, the Lone Star State? A state was founded after armed battles,
right,
in order to protect it. the Bear Flag Republic. Well, then we have 50 flags plus the U.S. flag protected. I mean, where does this stop? And so that was some of the reasoning but behind our opinion. And once again, the object of the written opinion is to try to persuade people to agree with the result.
People, just the public or also justices? Both.
Well, both. The first thing you have to do is convince your fellow justices, which is not an easy job. And to keep the respect of the other branches of the government. Remember that every government official has a duty to obey the Constitution. It's not just because the court tells you what to do. And in fact, there are many instances in which an official makes an act or a determination that can't come before the court, doesn't develop into a case. And it's even more important there for the official to understand that he or she must obey the Constitution and what they do.
I want to back up just one moment to button something up when we talked about the Obergefell and Hodges decision. Are you worried that that ruling or the principle behind it could change now? Is there a new willingness to maybe roll that back? Does that concern you, or is that just part of the process, that things change over time and if feelings about these matters change over time?
Well, your opinions have reasons for them, and if the court thinks the reasons are unsound, it has the power to change it. There would be tremendous harm. So again, the hundreds of thousands of children would be put back into a most difficult position. One of the things about stare decisis means you're bound by an earlier decision, is that it allows people to have confidence that the law will remain. Now, it's not, just as we mentioned in the death penalty case, the minor's death penalty case, sometimes you do change.
And it's a living, breathing sort of thing that evolves. Let's talk a little bit about the climate. You know, many Americans these days feel the court is more, everything seems more political, but people seem to think that the court is more political than judicial these days. Do you think that's fair? You hear people say all the time that it's President Trump's court now. And is that hyperbole? Is it accurate, inaccurate? Is the Supreme Court more political than it's?
Well, once again, as we've indicated, we have this hostile, fractious discourse in society generally, especially on political issues. And it's important that it not reach the court. The court, in its opinions, has to be very careful not to attack the judges, but to attack the reasons that they give. And if it slides into attacks on the judges, then we're bringing partisanship on the court. As you indicated, most presidents have appointed judges of their own political party. Eisenhower didn't. He appointed William Brennan, and Earl Warren, arguably, you know, an independent, and other presidents over time. Herbert Hoover had the duty to appoint the successor of Oliver Wendell Holmes, one of the most famous judges who ever lived in any country. And he asked members of the bar who was a brilliant enough judge to replace Holmes, and it was a very liberal judge, Benjamin Nathan Cardozo, and Hoover appointed him. So it's not always that you appoint someone from the same party. And it seems to me that partisanship in the nomination process has become all too dominant. I think it's a factor. You can't avoid it. But there should be more emphasis on the judge's learning temperament.
Let's talk for a few moments about one of the other chapters in your book and some issues today surrounding that, which is judicial ethics. You write, high ethical standards must insist upon independence from political interventions or pressures. We've talked about that a little bit here. Judges must not be threatened with adverse consequences or retaliation for their rulings. Definite, specific standards of moral and ethical behavior are essential in human undertakings. Several of your former colleagues, Your Honor, as you well know, have faced intense scrutiny over undisclosed gifts and trips. Should Supreme Court justices be subject to a binding code of ethics like other federal judges? Is there a problem on the Supreme Court?
I'm not sure how I've come out on that question. Of course, judges should have high ethical standards. And you say, well, that's over. Write them down. Just so you know, all district judges, trial judges, all circuit court judges are bound by a written code of ethics. And one reason the Supreme Court doesn't have is who would enforce this? Do you have an enforcement committee that can enforce judges? And so the thought has always been the judges should recuse themselves if there's any questions. And in my view, it seems to me that the press is an important safeguard to expose decisions on whether or not you recuse. If you have an ethical conflict, your duty is to recuse yourself. That means to get off the case. On the Supreme Court, that means it might be 4-4, and you have a court that can't reach a decision. But it seems to me very important that there be a high code of ethics. Mary and I learned that when we were in Sacramento and I was on the Court of Appeals. We were just surprised at how often we had to be very careful about not participating in certain events in order to preserve neutrality. And we talked a lot about it. The spouse of a judge has to pay a real price, and he or she, the spouse of the judge, cannot participate in certain affairs that a judge himself or herself could not participate in.
You touched on it, but I know there's an enforcement issue, but should the Supreme Court, given some of the things that have made the news in the last couple of years, be held to a written code of ethics like other judges?
It seems to me that the code of ethics is that it might not be specific enough. It seems to me that there's not very much question about what those ethics should be.
Yeah, okay. Something else just popped into my mind. The last several years, there's been talk about adding members to the Supreme Court. And, of course, both sides, you know, that depending on where they are at the moment. Is that a non-starter? Is that a good idea? Is 9 enough?
The Supreme Court at one time was 10. Lawfully, another time of 7. But for many years, it's been 9. Franklin Roosevelt, as many of you know, in his first term of office, found that some of his most important legislation was declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court.
Mm.
And he didn't say much about it during his reelection campaign, but the first thing he did when he had his second term was to tell his attorney general and others to draft a statute increasing the court. And what he did was, his idea was to have a new appointee for every judge over, I'll make it up, I think 70. And that would give him 5 new judges. And he said, oh, the judges are overworked. Well, no one really believed that. It was interesting because in that election where he was elected the second time, the Democrats swept the country. I think there were something like only 14 Republicans in the United States Senate.
Mm.
And so Roosevelt, maybe that's a little, well, maybe 19. So Roosevelt was ready to pass this statute. And the Republicans had what was called the conspiracy of silence. They knew that if it became a Republican-Democrat issue, they were finished.
Right.
So they just had what's called the conspiracy of silence. And sure enough, a fighting new dealer, Wheeler from Montana, was against this. And so he organized a campaign in the Senate to stop this bill. And he was successful. The bill failed to pass. It's interesting that at any time, Roosevelt probably could have gotten 2 or 3 new judges of compromise.
Right.
Not 15, but the, and he said, no, the people are with me. I know it. People were not.
They were not. You retired in 2018. Explain the decision to retire. Why did you leave the high post?
It's hard to leave something you love, but not so hard if you do it for something you love more, which was Mary.
She,
we were very careful to talk about ethics, never to talk about pending cases. Mary never knew what I was reading. She never knew what the discussions in the court was. She never said, please vote yes or no. We just had this rule, but it meant that for many evenings I had to sit and read briefs and I couldn't talk to Mary about what we were doing. And so that was one reason. The other reason is, let's face it, sometimes it's difficult for me to work the TV unless one of my grandchildren helps. you can go over your AI, you know, what's it mean? It seems to me that it's important.
my daughter pointed out to me not long ago, one of the great achievements of Washington. Washington had at least three great achievements. One is he won the war. Third, he became a great president. And in between, people don't often remember, he was the president of the Constitutional Convention that met in Philadelphia in 1787. And big states, little states, they would have arguments. And a few points, some delegate from the states there, we're going to leave. And the general said, gentlemen, please stay. And you didn't walk out on the general. And he kept them there for 3 months to give the great contribution. But another contribution he made was to resign after his second term, to indicate that there are other younger people that can contribute to our society, to our Constitution, to our freedom. And it seems to me that was an important example, and it was time for me to leave.
Were you criticized for the decision?
Not by my wife.
Because that is, of course, Supreme Court positions are lifetime appointments. Should they be lifetime appointments? I know that it's designed to keep it above the political fray, but should they be lifetime appointments, or should more step down as you did at an appropriate time?
No, in my view, they should be lifetime appointments. If presidents like to appoint younger judges, for the obvious reason,
right,
they'll be there longer. And if you had a 15-year term there, as an example, you don't pick a number, but a lot of the proposals are 15-year term. It might mean that you have some judges that are a little bit older being appointed because you don't have to worry. You know, they can only stay there 15 years anyway.
You mentioned that you didn't really discuss ever what you were considering with Mary at the dinner table. After the opinions were written, did you ever get home and did Mary ever go, what were you guys thinking?
No, she was very good about that, and she sometimes says, I don't understand what you did. But she knew they were close skaters, and we didn't want to make that part of the marital relationship.
Yeah. What is the most difficult decision or deliberation of your career? It doesn't have to be Supreme Court, but I'm assuming it might be.
Well, I always said when I was on the court, it's the case I'm hearing now. The flag burning case was very difficult for me. The gay rights case was very, very difficult for me.
Because of personal beliefs?
Because of personal, and because we wanted to make sure that the court maintained its, only could maintain respect if you do the right thing.
And put the law
first. And it was important for me to be sure that we did the right thing.
I have some questions from the audience. Thank you for submitting these that I want to make sure we get to, some particularly interesting ones. This is kind of actually a funny question. Do current members of the court reach out to you for advice or opinions? Do you ever get a call?
Oh, no, only on very general things. We're very careful not to comment on pending cases or written opinions. This is just the nine. They do ask me questions sometimes about judicial ethics, about whether they're getting too large or whether they should take more cases. But we're very, very careful to ensure that we don't run in and try to influence their pending matters. Mm-hmm. We're very careful about that.
Also from the audience.
The judges meet in a conference room, and there are double doors to remind the justices themselves and everybody else that what goes on in that conference room is private.
Oh, interesting. This is from the audience. What is the best piece of professional advice that you received, and who was it from?
I think maybe from my constitutional law professor as an undergraduate. I took, at Stanford, they had constitutional law as an undergraduate course. And I think it's very important for people that are not lawyers to take that course. If you're going to be a lawyer, you don't need to take it. But I took it. And he said, remember that the has a depth and a meaning that may not be apparent to you in the present day. We were in Thailand just after the terrible tsunami some years ago. And a priest came up, and we had breakfast together, And he'd been trying to counsel people that had lost their parents or lost their children. And he said it was interesting for young people. He gave them something to draw. It's the crayon technique. And he asked the child to draw what his life used to be like. And the child would draw that. Then he asked the child to draw what his life will be like in the future. And he asked the child to draw. Then he asked the child to draw what his life is now. And it was very, very difficult.
Mm.
And we know what our past is. We know what we want our future to be. We may be wrong. But if you asked, what is the status of the present, that's sometimes unclear.
I have two more questions for you to end. Your Honor, what would you tell people who read the book Life, Law, and Liberty? What would you want them to take away about life, law, and liberty and this republic?
Well, I want them to take away the idea that civility is the beginning point. We've talked about this already, for preserving the Constitution. We must reach out first to our friends of different persuasion and convince them that we must work together to bring more civility to our discourse. We must then reach out to members of our community to say the same thing. We must reach out to our nation to say the same thing, because we want to do this now with our friends, now with our community, now with our nation. We don't have much time, but at the end, we want civility to protect our democracy now and freedom for generations to come.
Well said. This last question from the audience actually dovetails perfectly in a way. You and your wife have been married for more than 50 years, close to 60 years, I think, haven't you?
64 years.
64 years.
Still trying to get it right.
Yeah. So, 64 years, any advice someone in the audience would like to know to a happy and long marriage? I suppose civility is a big part of that.
It is, and it's to understand that the fascinating part about love is that it survives in sad times and also in joyful times, to remember that we sometimes pray when we have tragedies in our family and sadness, but we must pray every day to thank the world for joy and to remember joy.
Our thanks to Justice Anthony Kennedy, author of Life, Law, and Liberty, a memoir, and the Travers Family Foundation for supporting today's program. I'm Dan Ashley. Thank you very much for your kind attention today. Please, one more hand for the remarkable Justice Anthony Kennedy.
Thank you for listening to the latest Commonwealth Club radio show. I'm Gloria Duffy, co-president and co-CEO of the club. Tonight, you heard former Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy speaking with Dan Ashley. He's the author of Life, Law, and Liberty, a memoir. Earlier in the program, we heard Justice Kennedy read an excerpt from his new book. The audio clip was provided courtesy of Simon & Schuster Audio, used with permission from Simon & Schuster, LLC. The full recording is available wherever audiobooks are sold. Please join us again next week when we hear from Abby Phillip speaking about the storied history of Reverend Jesse Jackson. This program is a production of Commonwealth Club World Affairs of California. You can learn more about us and our events at commonwealthclub.org. Join the millions of people who've caught our programs on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. And when you're in the Bay Area, we would love to see you in person at Commonwealth Club World Affairs of California's beautiful waterfront home. To hear the entire hour-long version of these conversations, download the program from the club's website or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. You can also enjoy this program in high-def video on our YouTube channel, Commonwealth Club World Affairs of California. While you're there, click the subscribe button. Help us get to 250,000 YouTube subscribers. Thanks for listening. And thank you for your support.
Support for KQED comes from European Sleepworks, the store that bases its design and materials on research factors affecting sleep, including comfort and support, humidity levels, and ease of breathing. Details online about their mattresses and bedding at sleepworks.com. And from PG&E, reminding customers to act quickly if they smell gas in their homes or business. Get outside, travel a safe distance away, and call 911. First responders will make it safe. Learn more at pge.com/safety. News from the BBC is coming up next. A donor-advised fund is one of the most tax-efficient ways to give. Maximize your charitable impact by recommending a grant to KQED to support the public media you and your community rely on. Learn more at kqed.org/DAF. And thank you. This is KQED.